Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. U.S. President Barack Obama is brushing off taunts from Iran and political complaints in the United States about the international deal to restrain Tehran's nuclear program. In an interview aired Sunday on CNN, Mr. Obama dismissed the importance of a tweet from Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, showing an apparent silhouette of the American leader with a gun to his own head. "I think that he tweeted that," said Mr. Obama, in response to me stating a fact, which is that if we're confronted with a situation in which we could not resolve this issue diplomatically, that we could militarily take out much of Iran's military infrastructure. I don't think that's disputable. President Obama told CNN's Fareed Zakaria, "Superpowers don't respond to taunts." Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has proposed eliminating the positions of vice president and deputy prime minister. It's part of a series of reforms to reduce corruption and improve government. Mr. Abadi announced a proposal Sunday. It comes weeks after protests against mismanagement and a lack of services, including not providing consistent electricity. The plan calls for cutting Iraq's three vice presidents, which include Mr. Abadi's predecessor, Nouri al-Maliki. Israel responded further to Jewish extremists Sunday by arresting suspects in West Bank settlements and placing two high-profile radicals under a type of detention that allows for holding them for 6 months without charges. Police said the raids are linked to recent events in the West Bank, but did not say how many suspects were detained. The crackdown on extremists follows a July 31st firebombing in the West Bank that killed an 18-month Palestinian child and his father. VOA News. Pope Francis has called for a global ban on nuclear weapons Sunday.
70 anni fa, il 6 e il 9 agosto.
The Pope's call comes as Japan marked the 70th anniversary of the U.S. dropping an atomic bomb on Nagasaki days before the end of World War II. The pontiff said the memories of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in early August 1945 remain a call for nuclear disarmament. After so long, that tragic event still causes horror and repulsion, bells tolled. And tens of thousands of people in Japan observed a minutes of silence Sunday to mark the Nagasaki attack that killed 74,000 people. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for another deadly suicide car bombing in Afghanistan. It comes a day after a series of terrorist blasts killed more than 50 in and near Kabul. In a statement sent to VOA, the Taliban says it was behind Saturday's explosion in the Khananabad district north of the northern Kunduz province. Afghan officials said Sunday that the death toll from that blast had risen to 29. Meanwhile, Pakistan says the spike in deadly terrorists underscores the need for peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. Ayaz Ghul has details on that.
Afghans are once again pointing fingers at Pakistan, alleging their neighbor is not preventing the Taliban from using its territory for staging the attacks. Pakistani National Security Advisor Sartaj Aziz has dismissed those charges, saying there are all kinds of militant factions operating in Afghanistan, making it difficult to ascertain who is behind the bloodshed. Pakistan brokered and hosted inaugural talks between Afghan government and Taliban officials in early July, but Mullah Umar's death prompted the insurgent group to pull out of the next round of negotiations. Aziz says Pakistan can persuade the Taliban to re-engage in talks with the Afghan government only after the group resolves its leadership problem. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
A surge in migrants from Africa threatens the EU's living standards and social structures. That's according to British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond. His comment Sunday saying the bloc was unable to take in millions of people seeking a new life. Hammond's comments, some of these most outspoken yet on the subject, underscore how the British government is ramping up its anti-immigration rhetoric in response to a spike in migrant attempts to reach Britain via the Channel Tunnel from France. They're also part of a wider EU trend that they cannot cope with the number of immigrants. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
There's a gentleman who said he's standing for this year's election. Mr. Fingesa is no longer part of the FPI.
Ivory Coast opposition party plans to boycott the upcoming October 25th presidential election.
There is speculation that Professor Lipumba leaving might have something to do with the ruling party trying to stir up trouble in the alliance.
An analyst says the defection of former Tanzanian Prime Minister to the opposition party causes a rippling effect in both the opposition and the ruling parties.
We had the need to reclaim the media and tell our own stories. So that's why we came up with a story called Reclaiming the Media Project. We tell the world this is who we are.
And Uganda's fourth annual Gay Pride Parade took place Saturday despite threats of violence. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A spokesman for former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo's Ivorian Popular Front, or FPI, says there's a split within the party. This after rejecting reports that Pascal Affi N'Guessan will lead the party in the upcoming October 25th presidential election. Boubacar Konni told me earlier that the FPI will not participate in the poll, citing prevailing political and security conditions, which he says are not conducive for peaceful, transparent and credible election.
There's a gentleman who said he's standing for this year's election. Mr. Fingesa is no longer part of the FPI, so he cannot be our candidate. That's the first thing I wanted to point out. Second of all, we haven't decided yet to participate in this election for many reasons. The first one is that the gentleman who is our current president is not eligible. He needs to withdraw his candidacy. The second thing we have to say is that the conditions are not yet gathered for a fair election in Cote d'Ivoire as we speak.
Is there a split in former President Gbagbo's UPI party?
Former President Laurent Gbagbo's party is not taking part in this coming election in these conditions, in the current conditions, in the sense that the Electoral Commission is imbalanced, the Constitutional Court is made up of Mr. Ouattara's friends, and cannot be fair. The census for the voters is biased. There are so many problems we have to solve first.
What is your next line of action since you are not participating in the coming election?
Our next plan of action is that we have to act so that the conditions are better. We have to force the current president to start discussions with us so that the conditions can be fair.
So you are willing to engage the president and his administration to improve situations before you participate in any elections? Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. We have to sit and talk and decide in a consensual way what are going to be fair conditions for this coming election.
Now, so let me ask you, so this gentleman who says he is representing former President Gbagbo's party is not representing the party, as you said, because...
No, not at all, not at all. Mr. Affi was excluded during the last Congress, which took place on April the 30th. this year. He was excluded from the party. So he cannot stand on behalf of the party he does not belong to.
Is there a split? Because obviously he says he's standing for the party in the election and you're saying he's not.
There is a split. There is a split of line. He's no longer from our party because he's not working according to the regulations of the party. So he was excluded, as I said.
Boubacar Kone is a spokesman for a faction of former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo's Ivorian Popular Front, or FPI. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Abidjan. A prominent member of Tanzania's opposition alliance has resigned from the Civic United Front, CUF, party days after former Prime Minister Edward Lowassa joined the opposition Chadema party. This following the former Prime Minister's defection from the ruling Chama cha Mapinduzi party, or CCM. Professor Xavier Lwaitama of the Josiah Kibera University College told me the defection of the former Prime Minister causes a seismic political shift in both the ruling party and the opposition alliance in the run-up to the poll.
I suspect that Professor Lipumba had thought that one presidential candidate would be himself, because he was at least one of the most prominent of the opposition parties in an alliance called the UKAWA. So, this other party, having selected, Edward Lowassa as a candidate, must have upset the political ambitions, the legitimate political ambitions of Professor Lipumba, because now he can't carry the alliance ticket of UKAWA. And it looks like his party secretary general is happy with the deal. So it is not surprising that he had to leave. But that is one of the political earthquakes that are expected when a big shot like former Prime Minister leaves a ruling party like CCM.
Professor Lwaitama, what does this do to the opposition coalition ahead of the October 25th general election, particularly when the political environment appeared to show that the CCM could be challenged this time around?
That is why there is speculation that Professor Lipumba leaving might have something to do with the ruling party trying to stir up trouble in the alliance, because for the first time, the major opposition parties have an alliance, and they have agreed to field one presidential candidate instead of competing among themselves. So it is not surprising that Professor Lipumba is now being accused of having given in to pressure from the ruling party. But it's also possible that Professor Lipumba assessed that it is much better that he's not party to the alliance, because the candidate that is going to be fielded by the opposition alliance, Mr. Lowassa, has a lot of integrity issues around him, and there is a lot of misgivings about the opposition alliance fielding Mr. Edward Lowassa, much as he has a lot of influence in CCM.
Do you think the opposition alliance, UKAWA, as they call it, would have enough time to mend fences and to present a united front to challenge the dominance of the CCM ahead of the October general election?
I think the assessment most independent analysts would give is that Mr. Lowassa has a large following in the ruling party. For his defection, most likely slice the ruling party's fortunes into two. That influence, when he brings it to the opposition, it is likely to twist the balance in terms of electoral fortunes in favor of the opposition, much as there will be those in the opposition, like Professor Lipumba, who may have misgivings and might decide to step aside. Those who might object to Edward Lowassa joining them are fewer in the opposition compared to the many who will join the opposition following Mr. Lowassa into the opposition. So it is possible that, and again, one has to realize that the opposition party CAF is more strong in Zanzibar than on the mainland, and the party that is strong on the mainland is the one which has accepted Mr. Lowassa. So I think in terms of electoral fortunes, I don't think that Professor Lipumba's stepping aside, and remember he has said he's stepping aside, I don't think that by itself makes it difficult for the opposition alliance to stitch its alliance together and make a bid for what is the one would assess to be the only time in Tanzanian history when the ruling party seems to have divided itself into two.
Briefly, Professor Loitama, do you think the defection of Edward Lowassa causes any headache to the powers that be in the ruling CCM, since the party has dominated the political landscape in Tanzania since the country gained independence in 1961?
You see, the name Edward Lowassa came up in 1995. It almost won the ticket of CCM to be the presidential candidate, and it's not been for the objection and opposition of the late Mwalimu Nyerere. This time round, Mwalimu Nyerere is not around, and 2005, Mr. Edward Lowassa led a grouping within CCM called Mtandao Network, which actually is the one which actually made it possible for the incumbent president, Mr. Kikwete, to be president. So Mr. Lowassa is not just like any other member of CCM. He is a former prime minister, but he's also a very influential member of CCM, and he's the one who actually made it possible for the current incumbent president to be president. So it is a big earthquake within CCM.
That was Professor Xavier Loitama of the Josiah Kibera University College. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. During his recent visit to Africa, President Barack Obama called on African leaders to respect term limits. One such long-serving leader is Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe. By sure, presidential term limits define democracy on the continent. Clifford Mashiri is a former Zimbabwean diplomat in Addis Ababa. Reporter Douglas Impuga reached him in London for a reaction to the idea of term limits.
This is a very disturbing scenario whereby the president of Zimbabwe, Mr. Mugabe, has changed the constitution several times, and the new one which was adopted, in 2013, he has already started tampering with it, and he does not want to leave power. He has been in power for 35 years, and he looks like he is also going to run for elections in 2018. And by the time he leaves office, if he ever leaves, he will be 99 years old.
Doesn't that fit the description of life presidency?
This is exactly what President Obama was talking about at the African Union, where he was condemning this life president, saying nobody should be a life president. We want to believe he had in mind Mugabe. Well, that speech was great. It was very inspiring. It was well received. We say so because of the applause, a lot of applause and standing ovations that he received from civil society, and even some of the heads who were there who appreciated what he was talking about. And it was well received in that respect. He was covering very vital, relevant, and pertinent contemporary issues of leaders who are not willing to leave power and who are changing constitutions or are in breach of the law.
The mere fact that the people, or the people in Africa, in several countries, felt that they had put that check there, doesn't that make it a crucial part of the system, of the process?
Oh, yes, you are quite right. It makes it a part of the process. It is also accurate to say that term limits are not necessarily, part or we could say hard and fast rules, because some leaders in Western countries have ruled for more than two terms, as we may know, even here in the United Kingdom, that has happened before. But the emphasis is it should be accepted as a convention. A convention is a practice that we take and use over and over when we accept it as part of our democracy.
Clifford Mashiri is a former Zimbabwean diplomat in Addis Ababa. He spoke with reporter Douglas Mpuga from London. Uganda's fourth annual Gay Pride Parade took place Saturday in Entebbe, a risky venture in a country with a history of prosecuting lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender Ugandans. Many now say they are finding their voice. Elizabeth Pola has more from Entebbe.
On Saturday afternoon, LGBT Ugandans converged on the shores of Lake Victoria in Entebbe to celebrate who they are. In a country where the vast majority is against homosexuality, coming out in the open can be risky. Yet the celebrations were a light-hearted affair. Prominent members of the community were there and assured participants the police would offer protection. This year, the parade was flanked by LGBT activities in Kampala, including choosing Mr. and Miss Pride. It is another sign that Uganda's LGBT members are taking baby steps out into the open. This was evident by the coverage of Kuchu Times, an African LGBT media house that originated in Uganda and has members all over East Africa. Ambrose Baraji, the media field officer for the organization.
Most of the times, the Ugandan media has reported negatively about the Ugandan LGBT movement. And take an example of the red paper outings. We saw we had the need to reclaim the media and tell our own stories. So that's why we came up with a story called Reclaiming the Media Project. We tell the world this is who we are. These are the real stories. No one coming and telling a wrong story about us.
Uganda has harsh anti-homosexuality laws and last year passed a law imposing life sentences for homosexual acts. The country's highest court struck down the law, but not before it generated international criticism from human rights organizations. Many who attended Saturday's event say they are determined to change Uganda from the inside out. They say that although some of the international community have disparaged Uganda, they are proud of their heritage and are certain they can build acceptance. Fiona Adebayo, a transgender man who won the title of Mr. Pride this year, says he believes in time things will change.
I came out to show the world, to show Uganda, the homophobia country, that we are here to stay and we shall stay because we are born Ugandans and we should not go for asylum in other countries, yet this is our home country.
Participants say each year the Pride Parade has become bolder, taking longer routes and growing louder. They hope that one day it will no longer take place in Entebbe's Botanical Gardens, but in the streets of Kampala. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Entebbe, Uganda.
In Sierra Leone, some emergency regulations for the Ebola outbreak have been lifted. The restrictions were placed a year ago to help stop the spread of the disease. For VOA reporter Kelvin Lewis has the details from the capital, Freetown.
Sierra Leoneans have generally breathed a sigh of relief as President Ernest Bai Koroma announced a relaxation of the public health restrictions, which were meant to curb the spread of the deadly Ebola virus. About a year ago, the president imposed a state of emergency, which gave him extra powers to quarantine people suspected of having made contact with the virus. The president had also banned all public gatherings or meetings of people more than a dozen. Schools and colleges, nightclubs and restaurants were also closed, and markets were no longer to open on Sundays. But as the number of Ebola infections came down from 500 a week to single-digit patients nationwide, the president gradually relaxed the then tight regulations. These were not enough for opposition politicians, who said the emergency regulations were a ploy by the ruling government to clamp down on opposition activities. Restaurant and nightclub owners were crying that they were going bankrupt. The youths were angry they were not allowed to watch English Premiership matches at video clubs, and market women were crying for longer market hours. As the state of emergency expired after its first year on the 6th August, the president on the 7th August imposed a fresh state of emergency, which may last for another year. He, however, lifted some of the Ebola restrictions, like the ban on public gatherings and meetings. Restaurants and nightclubs were now allowed to open, but to adhere to rules about temperature testing and washing of hands. The youths could now watch their Premier League matches and also involving sporting activities. The peace and quiet which used to reign under the restrictions was now shattered, as loud music from bars and nightclubs were now heard all over. The president, however, warned that this does not mean Ebola is over and that the people should remain vigilant. It is not clear how many people will heed that advice. For most people, after sitting at home for a whole year, it was now time again to put on their dancing shoes. For VOA Africa, I'm Kelvin Lewis reporting from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
Meanwhile, in Liberia during the Ebola crisis, UNICEF says the births of over 70,000 children were not officially recorded. Without an official identity, they would likely not receive social services or could be illegally adopted. Today, the UN agency is supporting the drive by the government of Liberia to register the newborns. Deirdre Kernan is UNICEF's acting representative for Liberia. VOA's William Eagle asked her about the effort to support the children.
It was mainly happening because of the Ebola outbreak. And if you look at how Ebola went in Liberia, it was very bad for a period of time. It went up really fast, the number of cases. And health facilities, for the most part, shut down. People were terrified to go to health facilities because they were afraid they'd get Ebola if they went there. And health facilities and chiefs and communities are the people who register births. So no one was going to bring a newborn infant to a health facility to have their child registered in that kind of chaos and fear, situation of fear. So that's why the registrations went down.
How are children marginalized? And in what way specifically are children harmed if they are lacking a birth certificate?
Well, it harms society overall because you just don't know who exists and who doesn't. You're taking away statehood by not providing a child with a birth certificate. To which country do they belong? They're not counted, and if they're not counted, they're invisible, which then means state services can't be calculated properly because you don't know how many children there are. You don't know where to put the schools, the health facilities, how many teachers you should have because you can't project because you don't have accurate numbers of children. It can affect things like child marriage. How do you prevent a child marriage if you can't prove this is actually a child and not an adult?
How soon will children be able to be registered? Are they being registered now or is it already happening?
Services are available, but we want to hold a campaign later in the year. We're going to support the government to hold a campaign later in the year, like was done in Sierra Leone, to do a big catch-up and catch all those kids who weren't registered during Ebola and all the children who were being born in 2015.
UNICEF says it's supporting the revamp of registration systems. What changes are you proposing in that revamp?
It's not really proposing changes. It's just getting the system back up online again. We've already provided a lot of the infrastructure to do it, the computers, the printers, the paper, the registers, trained people. But the campaign will be, you know, get it back up in the public eye again, get it in the newspapers, on the radio, work through community leaders, social mobilization to get people to bring their children forward to register them.
Were children also not registered before the Ebola crisis?
Well, it was at 4% and it got up to about 25% before the Ebola outbreak. So in a country where it's not really part of the culture to register children, you know, people don't see the immediate benefits of why they should register their child. They're not thinking that long term. It has to become a habit. So the best thing is to make it easily available, free, and as soon as the child is born, make sure it's happening. So that's what was happening. UNICEF, along with partners like the World Bank, provided all the support, setting up the system, making sure there were servers in the capital to capture all the data, and make sure there was a system in place that was available at the village level, at the community level. And, you know, slowly it was happening. Most of it was happening in Monrovia. But now, when Ebola came and it went back down again because of, obviously, the crisis and health facilities not working and people being so afraid, now that that's over, or nearly over, we need to get it going again. And you just have to make it popular, have to get people excited about getting their children registered.
If I'm a parent and I want to register my child either now or after the campaign begins, mm-hmm. What is the process? Where would I go?
You go either to a health facility or you go to the general town chief's office, and they have a ledger, they register everything, and they send it to the district registrar at the district level, and then they send it on to the county level. On the county level, it gets input into a computer, and the birth certificate is printed, and then it gets sent back down, and you get the certificate delivered to you.
That was Deirdre Kernan of UNICEF in Liberia. She spoke with VOA's William Eagle from the capital, Monrovia. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Ademi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Ademi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, August 9th. With two matches to go, Algerian club USM Alger has become the first team to qualify for the semifinals of the 2015 CAF Champions League. In a Group B match day four played on Friday, USM defeated fellow Algerian club MC Yulma 1-0. To win the maximum 3 points at stake. The long goal was scored by a header from defender Mohamed Mefta. Friday's victory was the fourth straight win for USM, which now has the maximum 12 points from four matches atop its group. With two matches remaining, USM, known as the Reds and Blacks, is 8 points ahead of title holder AS Setif, also of Algeria, and Al Merrikh of Sudan. Debutant MC Yulma remains at the bottom without a point after four matches. Turning to Group A, TP Mazembe won for the first time at home at the group stage after a long goal victory over Smuha of Egypt on Saturday in Lubumbashi, the Democratic Republic of Congo. Ivorian Roger Asali was the hero, scoring a spectacular goal in the second half to send TP Mazembe top of the group on 8 points, three more than Maghreb Tetouan of Morocco and Sudanese side Al Hilal. Debutant Smuha, which suffered its third consecutive loss at the group stage, stays at the bottom with 3 points. Staying with African club football, the fourth round of matches in the group stage of the CAF Confederation Cup are also being played this weekend in the two groups A and B. In Group A, Tunisian club Etoile du Sahel is back at the top after a long goal victory over defending champion Al Ahly of Egypt on Saturday in Suez. Striker Youssef Moibi scored the only goal, converting a first-half penalty to ensure the Tunisians avenge a similar loss in the reverse game a fortnight ago in Egypt. The third win at the group stage takes Etoile's tally to 9, two more than Al Ahly, which achieved the historic feat of becoming the first Egyptian side to lay its hands on the second-tier Continental Club Championship and is poised to defend the crown. In Group B, CS Sfaxien of Tunisia was eliminated following his 2-0 loss to South African club Orlando Pirates at the Orlando Stadium in Johannesburg on Saturday. The Pirates scored one goal in each half to make up their winning tally. Group leader Zamalek has a chance to go 3 points clear of Pirates on a maximum of 12 points if it defeats AC Leopards in Congo later today, Sunday. Now, to the final draw for the 2015 FIFA Under-17 World Cup to be hosted by Chile. The four teams that will represent Africa at the tournament, Guinea, Mali, Nigeria, and South Africa, are all in tough first-round groups. At the final draw on Thursday in Santiago de Chile, Guinea was drawn with England, Brazil, and South Korea in what could be the toughest group for any of the African teams. For its part, the most successful team at the FIFA Under-17 World Cup, four-time winner Nigeria, is in Group A with host Chile, Croatia, and the United States. Mali has Belgium, Honduras, and Ecuador to contend with in Group D, while South Africa will face Costa Rica, North Korea, and Russia in Group E. But without doubt, the overall group of death is Group C, which contains European and South American powerhouses Germany and Argentina, as well as Australia and Mexico. Turning to athletics, it's just about 2 weeks to go to the IAAF World Championships, tagged Beijing 2015. The championships will take place between August 22nd and 30th. Many of the IAAF's 214 member federations have already named their teams for the most important sporting event on this year's calendar. Midnight on Monday is the final entry deadline. That means this weekend offers the last chance for athletes to qualify and for member federations to name their teams. Finally, boxing. Manny Pacquiao says he wants a rematch with Floyd Mayweather Jr. in 2016 after losing by unanimous decision in their first meeting, which failed to live up to the massive hype back in May. Pacquiao is still not happy with how the fight played out. He believes he deserved victory with his more aggressive style. He says Mayweather was running away all the time. The undefeated Mayweather had earlier said he was open to a rematch. After the dust settled on their fight, however, he changed his mind, calling Pac-Man a sore loser and a coward. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
I'm I'm in your presence to have my own portion. With you, I sure not one. And I sure lock nothing. I will never let you go, Jesus, unless you bless me, Baba. Give me my own share, Daddy. That is why I'm in your presence. You will carry my.
Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The government and people of Egypt deserve great respect and credit for demonstrating conclusively that an African country with proper leadership and determination can accomplish a great project by relying solely on its own resources. Last Thursday, the President of Egypt, in the presence of a number of heads of state, open the enlargement of the Suez Canal, which was accomplished by the resources of the Egyptian people alone. A few years ago, the government of Egypt, with great international fervor, called on the Egyptian people to help fund the opening and widening of the Suez Canal. Within 2 weeks, the people of Egypt raised the amount of over $8 billion by themselves without resorting to international lending agencies or foreign governments. In addition, the government called on the people of Egypt to accomplish the project not in 3 years as had been projected, but in a year. Bring together enough resources of dredging in the world, that great project was accomplished in 1 year. Now, there are critics in Egypt who have said that the present government of Egypt had used the project to cover off its massive violation of human rights and its continuing persecution of the opposition. But the fact of the matter is that the Suez Canal is a significant project in the international community. In 1859, French resources entrepreneurs decided to reduce the time for traveling from Europe to Asia by going through a new Suez Canal instead of going round the Cape of Good Hope. This engineering project was accomplished, and one of Britain's great prime ministers realized the significance of that project and was able to buy in to the project. Benjamin Disraeli realized that Britain could maintain its imperial domination in Asia by using the Suez Canal. Following the revolution in Egypt, the new leader, Gamal Abdel Nasser, decided to build another major project, the Aswan High Dam. He went to the international community to raise the funding. He received the commitment, but for one reason or the other, the then American Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, decided to pull out of that project. Nasser was so shocked that he decided to retaliate. He made the risky decision to nationalize the International Canal Company of Suez. That created the first major crisis in the world since the end of the Second World War. In a now heavily documented conspiracy involving England, France, and Israel, the two imperial powers, France and England, reoccupied the Canal Zone and Israel occupied Sinai. United States President Eisenhower was infuriated and opposed that intervention. And a Secretary General of the UN, Doug Armistead, and the President of the U.S. were able to compel the withdrawal of France and England. It was seen that this was the first evidence of the reduction of the imperial ambitions of those two countries. Now, the canal was for over 8 years closed because Nasser had sunk boats in the canal. Only after the October War of 73 did the canal flourish again. So we now have this project of expansion. It is believed that the revenue will increase in the canal. But this is not the main point which should be emphasized, because the critics say they will never realize the revenues projected. What I wish to emphasize, and all Africa must understand, that a government in Africa could move away from relying on foreign resources for major projects. It should be made very clear that never could a country prosper if it continues to rely on outside resources for the advancement of its people. I thank you.
That was Mamam's point of view, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Impuga, Producer Odette Frazier, Sports Editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, it is only when a lion is sick that the antelope visits him to reclaim an old debt. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The internet is rapidly becoming a major economic driver in the world, and its economic and social benefits are increasingly shifting to developing nations like Indonesia. The United States believes that the internet should be open and accessible to everyone, said U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Economic and Business Affairs Daniel Sepulveda in a speech in Indonesia. It will take a collective effort to bridge the digital divide, and that's why the United States is determined to work with Indonesia to expand broadband infrastructure and create an economic environment that enables affordable internet connections. Indonesia's impressive economic growth could help it realize the country's potential as a regional leader in the information and communications technology industry. This will not only reinforce existing economic development, but will also give more people invaluable opportunities to contribute to political, economic, and social discourse. Last year's creation of Indonesia's National Broadband Plan was an important first step in the process of bridging the digital divide in this country. The plan's ambitious use of the Universal Service Fund serves as a positive example for the entire ASEAN community, and its aim to connect all public sector facilities like health centers, government offices, and school buildings is of vital importance. As the internet has evolved into the critical resource it is today, governments are grappling with what their role should be and how much power or control they should be able to exercise. The U.S. believes governments must make a choice: to enable the internet's growth or detract from it. The internet has flourished because of the bottom-up, consensus-based process that allows all stakeholders to participate in its growth and governance. This market-driven, multi-stakeholder approach has worked well, and it is the strongest tool to help rapidly emerging economies like Indonesia embrace all the opportunities that the internet has to offer. The U.S. looks forward to partnering with Indonesia as the country works to reach its ambitious connectivity goals. Together, said Ambassador Sepulveda, we can create an environment in which innovation can flourish and connectivity can enrich more lives every day.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.